Welcome to Special Sauce, Serious Eats podcast about food and life. Every week on Special Sauce, we talk to some of the leading lights of American culture, food folks and non-food folks alike.
We really tried to get Netflix to buy it, no dice. We really tried to get HBO to buy it, no dice. But meanwhile, we were getting great buzz.
We are back with documentary filmmaker Thomas Lennon, whose terrific Oscar-nominated new film, Knife Skills, tells the story of Brandon Krastowski opening a white tablecloth French restaurant in Cleveland, Edwin's, employing only recently released convicts.
There's still this, you know, perception of people coming out of prison. We got to go farther. We got to go faster. Can't ever, ever say we've arrived.
Tom, making a great documentary short film is hard enough, but getting it noticed and seen and nominated for an Oscar is another. So first, I want to hear all about that. And then Brandon, of course, the same is true about opening a French restaurant with or without an experienced staff and making a go of it. So, Tom, let's start with you. It's like you found some money.
I found the money to finish the film. But, you know, there's a hell of a lot of films getting made these days. And anybody who's got, you know, $2,000 can get a great camera and start shooting something and then edit on a computer that costs $500. And so there's a lot of work getting done, and a lot of it is crap, but some of it's really good, and it's really tough out there. So after I finished it, I just did the normal thing, which is, you know, apply to a bunch of film festivals, got turned down by a number of film festivals. It's 40 minutes long, and that's a difficult length for festivals. They don't really, for understandable reasons, they don't really love it because, you know, people aren't going to go out of their home and come down to the movie theater and watch something for 40 minutes. So we got turned down a fair amount, and then we started not getting turned down, and then the first time we finally got into a film festival was Michael Moore's film festival in Michigan, and we won an audience award, and everybody went. Brandon was there with me, and Brandon actually was the first time he'd seen the film on on anything but his little computer.
And
the place went nuts. And I
crying,
mean, this sounds like
crying,
you know,
tears.
Filmmaker PR, but Brandon, you could back me up on this. The place went nuts. They stood up, and I think they were standing up, I think, more for Brandon than for the film, but the combination of the two, just being so excited by what the restaurant was trying to do and what the film had told them of, or had brought the universe that this film had brought them into, and they went crazy, and then they kept clapping and clapping. It felt to me like 10 minutes. It was probably about a minute and a half. I started almost crying.
Because
it was the end of like a 3.5 year
thing. I still cry when I watch the movie, and I've seen it six
times.
Tom,
I had to point this out, that there were three people in this crowd who weren't cheering, and it was the people who made the film before us. and they were sitting there.
That's true.
They were sitting there with this shit look face, and I remember looking at him. I was like, fuck you, you know? I just remember just looking at him like, you think you own a restaurant? You don't know how to run a restaurant. And I remember that feeling of looking at him, but you're right. It was they were crying. They were moved, and I think it was about 3-4 minutes of clapping. Man, it was more than a minute and a half.
And we should explain, Tom, why you arrived at 40 minutes.
Well, I was working with a great editor, Nick August Perna, and I said to him, "I don't care how long this film is. Let's just make the best film we know how." So we made different edits, and we made like a 50-minute cut, and then we cut a couple minutes out, and we kept changing things. And each time it got shorter, it got better. And then
it's like a sauce, Brandon, reducing.
Reducing. Yeah, but it is. It's just exactly the same idea. And then I think the natural length of the film is about 41 or 42 minutes or whatever. We were really happy with the film at that length. You cannot make a film for 42 minutes. If you can get under 40 minutes, you can be eligible for short film categories in film festivals and at the Oscars. If not, you got to do 52 minutes or so and do a broadcast hour. So I had to go either up or down, and I decided to squeeze it down, and it's a really tight.
It doesn't feel like it, though.
You mean it feels shorter or longer?
It doesn't feel like it's 40 minutes. There's just the way it comes together, it just feels like it feels like it's longer because there's so much, but it's smooth.
Good.
Yeah.
Good. And we didn't get any awards until we got the Oscar nomination. There are these award things that are the indicators of whether or not these other things as to whether or not you're going to get a chance at getting an Oscar nomination. And we got turned down by every one of them. We didn't even get into the competition. I don't mean we didn't win. We didn't even get picked to the shortlist. So I thought, you know, we are just so screwed. Our goose is cooked. And in fact, I know Ed, and so he was advising me, and I was saying to him, like, how the fuck can I get to Schiff's or somebody who will endorse this film? Like, I gotta get some life into it. And then I wrote Ed this email, and I said, you know, we're getting turned down by all the indicators of the Oscars, so I have to get used to the idea that that's probably not going to happen. And I think it was because there's so much packed into that film that they didn't feel like it was a short.
Yeah,
that's
yeah,
my
I
theory.
Would agree. I
could be wrong. Maybe they just didn't like it. But I think that's why.
Yeah. When you were at the film festival, the first film festival you got in Traverse City, Michigan, you still didn't have a distributor. You still didn't have a place to exhibit it. You didn't have anything.
Now you're going to ask, why does Ed Levine know all of these things? And that's because Tom Lennon was his friend and would call him up about every 2 or 3 weeks and cry about this. And I'd say, like, I'm dying. This film is dying. I can't get it anywhere. We really tried to get Netflix to buy it. No dice. We really tried to get HBO to buy it. No dice. But meanwhile, we were getting great buzz, and we had got it, made it eligible for the Oscars, and then we made it to the shortlist. That's 10 films that have a shot, out of which 5 are going to get a nomination. So then I thought, okay, now I'm in. Somebody's going to buy me. Nope, nobody bought me. Then we got the nomination, and then New Yorker Films actually had been courting us for a little while. They didn't have a lot of resources, but they said, you know, we can't pay you a ton, but we can really get this film on the map.
And this is the New Yorker magazine.
This is the New Yorker magazine, which is Condé Nast, which is, in fact, very committed to a website presence.
Yeah. And they've done a great job on the New Yorker website. It's quite brilliant.
I'm an old-fashioned guy, so I always read the magazine, so I didn't spend a lot of time looking at the website. When I started looking at it, like when they did an article about us that was on the website but that was not on the magazine, I got a ton of calls from people. So I realized that this has a real life I wasn't so aware of. And they've been pushing the film ever since, and it was a relief to get somebody behind us. But part of the strategy was, let's see if we can buy ourselves a ticket to the Oscar lottery and.
Yeah, and I remember talking to you and you know, we would go back and forth on music and chefs that we could get involved.
Right. Could we get a celebrity, a singer to like do part of the soundtrack? Would that help? Since Ed, A, has a cooking background, but B, had a music background, you know, I was clawing. This is the life of the independent producer. Take all your best friends and just exploit them horribly.
And, but then you had that screening in L.A. and, you know, I emailed Roy Choi's assistant, and Roy Choi is, of course, this great restaurateur and chef with a huge heart and does lots of things involving social justice. And he totally stepped up to the plate, right?
Upstaged me, man. We're at this damn screening, and I've paid a bunch of money to try and impress the Oscars, and Roy Choi just ran away with the show, but it was great.
Yeah.
He's a very charismatic chef. And he said something but right at the beginning of the thing. He said, you know, restaurants saved me. And that's, of course, a line right out of the film, because Brandon used almost an identical phraseology.
Yeah, he did use it. I wrote that down, actually. He used that exact same line. He said that exact same thing.
Yeah.
And I think that it's both a cautionary tale and a hopeful tale about making art in 2018 that has a strong message, but it doesn't give you any easy answers.
I'm not preaching.
Not preaching, and I think that's really great. And so that leads me to a question for you, Brandon, which is, the restaurant gets open, Tom's making his movie, you get to see it on a screen for the first time on a big screen in Traverse City. Then what happened with the restaurant?
Immediately after the Oscar nomination, you know, the restaurant, you know, does explodes, almost like back to the times when we first opened. But, you know, during this journey, I mean, no one really gave a shit about it, to be honest with you. They say, hey, this is great. You got there's a movie out about you that no one can see. Great. I mean, it doesn't do you. It does you no good.
Yeah. What's the good news?
It does you no good. But I mean, the restaurant itself, I mean, since the time of the shooting, you know, we built a campus. So there's housing for people. There's a fitness center, a library. There's graduate housing. Got another building, working on a butcher shop. We're in 13 prisons. So the train hasn't slowed down while this movie was being made or when it came out. But I can
just
tell
as
you.
Well, since it took me so goddamn
either
long.
Either way, yeah. I can tell you that when the Oscar nomination came through, that train just got put on, you know, some super fuel, and it's flying. I mean, it's just incredibly busy right now. Incredibly busy.
You do amazing work, Brandon. you just casually mentioned, oh, yeah, we've got housing and we have a butcher shop and we have a fitness center, all about your mission of reentry,
mm-hmm. yep.
right? Which you have made it your mission. And there are not too many people who can marshal resources and be so focused on something so singular and yet so important involving the culture mm-hmm. at large.
I mean, can I just say one thing, which is,
yeah.
So after the first class of people finished their 6 months, they moved all the chairs around in the restaurant and turned it into a kind of like a high school graduation. And they put bunting up and they put a big sign that said Edwin's. And all the graduates bring their families and dress to the kill and all sit. And then they each receive a diploma. And, you know, I'm struck by the fact that, like, what is this diploma? What is Edwin's? What is this thing? It just comes out of Brandon's head. And here we are 6 months later, and people are receiving a diploma with immense pride. So in other words, a miniature institution is born out of nothing.
And to create something that has meaning and value to many people is an amazing, amazing accomplishment. Is this what you imagined when you set out on this, as you say, this 10-year journey? That you're still on, right? This is not, you haven't gotten to your destination, mm-hmm. clearly. But did you imagine, oh yeah, and maybe we can eventually get a butcher shop and a program in a dozen prisons and we'll have housing? Like, was that all part of the...
Yeah, that was the plan, man. That was the plan. And the...
That was all there in your head?
It's all on paper. Listen, I was so paranoid someone would take this idea. I mailed the original business plan to myself, and I haven't opened it up since that 2004. You know that poor man's patent, right? And you're welcome to open it up and break the seal, but it's...
Now, can I just say you've just learned something very important about Brandon, which is part of the fuel that drives him is paranoia.
Yeah.
But
it's all there. But the thing
is,
here, I'll tell you what I didn't expect, the acceleration on this. Now the velocity of this has happened much faster. So like the campus, I didn't see till like year five. It happened in year two. A film I never put in the formula, but that's in fact there, and that's just accelerates a lot of.
That was one of the slower aspects of this thing, though, was getting the film
but
done.
Right.
Oh man, it took me forever because I couldn't.
I never expected a film to be made. So in this plan, this was never part of it, but it's just accelerate the mission spreading throughout the country, which was always a plan, changing the face of reentry.
I always tell people at Serious Eats, it's a long race. And the path is not linear. Clearly, you have embraced both those notions with the restaurant and the Leadership
Institute. We're so far from where we need to be. So whatever's been accomplished is like beneath the mountain, and you're climbing it, looking up, and I just keep saying, shit, we got to go farther. We got to go faster. And all this behind it, you know, you think you're fortunate for, but you can't ever, ever say, we've arrived, because we haven't. There's still another life. There's still this you know, perception of people coming out of prison. There's still this short stick, a vision of someone who's been incarcerated. So we're still just so far behind, so far behind.
Yeah. And it's such an overwhelming problem that society has not adequately addressed. Maybe because there are no easy answers. The answers are found in the kinds of things that you're doing, which is on a relatively small scale, but suggests a larger scale that if it was incorporated into other places would really make a difference all over mm-hmm. the country.
But that's the goal. We get there, though. We'll get there.
You seem to take the long view. I admire that.
And things of value take time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And, you know, like... This film was 4.5 years. It took, for you, Serious Eats was many years before you could stop worrying and you knew that it was going to survive. I watched you. You were a wreck. Was Serious Eats going to survive? And Brandon, as I say, started talking about this idea in like 2003 or 2004 and opened in 2013.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, what's interesting, Brand, is that you, it seems to me, unless I'm missing something, that you created this model. Mm-hmm. Like, there was nobody doing anything like this.
Can I say one thing?
Yeah.
I talked to the chairman of, who was then the chairman of his board, and who he recruited, and who then started helping raise money and stuff. And that guy reached out to various places that had, they had bakeries or catering things and stuff like that. And he said, we're going to do this high-end restaurant. And 201, everyone said, it's a bridge too far. Don't try to do it. Do not do it. So not only had people not believed that, not only had people not done it, they really thought it was a very bad idea.
Right. So was it?
And that's among people who were very pro improve. They were progressive.
Yeah.
They wanted to support reentry, but they just said, from prison to a high-end dining, white, what you call a white tablecloth dining experience, is too big a leap. You know, just stick to a bakery or a catering service.
Yeah, like home. I mean, Brandon, you must know about Homeboy Industries in L.A., which does amazing work. So, but there was no model, right? You just created this in your own head.
Man, the story of my life, and that's how I knew it would work. There's no denying that. If it worked for me, why couldn't it work for another human? And it was just about, you know, manufacturing and engineering a curriculum around that, and that was it, man. That was it. Yeah, there's nothing else like it. I think there's other things, like you said, Homeboys. They got other things around the country, but nothing to this level.
Yeah.
Because they didn't think it was possible. You don't understand. Like, you know, until you run like that 3-minute mile, 4-minute, well, whatever, you know, you break these records. Until you see it, then you don't know it's possible. And if you don't, when you live it, you know it's possible. So you've seen it. And other people didn't see that. So you can't expect someone else to say, come up with this idea. It can work, because they'd say it's impossible. I've never seen
right.
it. And that's really how, you know, I knew it would work. There was not a doubt in my mind it would work. Not a doubt in my mind. Bingo. And then you can replicate it. And now that's replicated, people see it. Now they see it a lot more of the movie. And now this is a chain reaction that hopefully can, you know, really change the tide across many, many continents, not just here.
And let me ask you both the same question. So, Brandon, you found yourself running for mayor in Cleveland, mm-hmm. I believe. It's not like you'd spent a lifetime in local Cleveland politics. I don't think you made your way up the Cleveland Democratic machine.
No. nor would I want to.
And was that, and again, that was just your pursuit of something that you thought was the right thing to do, and it would enable the city to make strides in a way that they wouldn't have made under somebody else's leadership.
Exactly. Put less tactfully, what the hell were you thinking of, Brandon? Yeah. Could you explain?
Thanks, Tom.
Yeah, what were you thinking,
exactly,
Brandon?
Exactly that. I couldn't help but see what we were doing here at Edwin's and helping those in the inner city, helping those that society has thrown and tossed into the rubbish. And then we were making great careers and lives, you know, from that experience, using that perspective. And you look at it citywide, how, you know, Cleveland's still the most distressed city. You know, unemployment's the highest. Infant mortality is that on par with a third world country. You've got, you know, 2,000 homeless school kids. You've got these numbers that you would say, are you kidding me? And to me, I said, if this guy runs again, I'm going to fight him. And that was the only thought I could think of. Then he announced. And the very next day, I announced. And I was like, this fucking guy has got some nerve to think he can keep doing this to us. He keeps doing this to us and keeps doing this to them. For 12 years, he's been mayor, screwing those that have less. And enough was enough. So that was it. It was just pissed off.
Was it really the day after?
The day after.
This brings us back to the fisticuffs theme of the first podcast. That's a fighter. You got something of the
so
fighter.
Maddening. So
and
maddening.
You didn't win. But you didn't come in last either.
I knocked out some 30-year politicians. We did good. We came in 4th out of 9. Only the top 2 advanced, so I was very, very close. I was maybe, I don't know, 6,000 or 7,000 votes shy of advancing.
Wow.
And that was like with a very low budget, no machine, just boots on the ground, knocking doors, and relentlessly saying the same thing that was right and resonated. It was fun.
So when we were in the... when we knew we had a shot at the Oscars, we'd been shortlisted down to 10, and of those, 50% were going to be going to get a nomination, and I have to admit, I really wanted it. I wanted it bad. I knew it would be great for the film, be great for me, great for Brandon. I wanted it.
I know, so Brandon, because just by how many emails I got.
So then so Brandon's like peppering me with emails, and he's saying, what are you doing? I explain all the various things I'm doing to try to increase our chances. He says, well, I mean, you haven't gone fucking door to door and knocked on people's Academy members' doors. And it was like, this is a little different from running for mayor. This is not quite the way we do it. But anyway.
What about you, Tom? I mean, now that you've had this experience with Knife Skills, and not, you know, many of your films have dealt with social justice issues, but I don't think you've ever seen, and you made that film about polluted river that did actually
have
cause
an impact, yeah,
political and social change in China.
Yeah.
But, I mean, now that you've seen the power of this kind of art, how does it frame what you're thinking about doing next?
I don't know the answer to that. I just know that it feels really good to have been involved in something worthwhile. And that doesn't capture it. There's a satisfaction that's like unbelievably deep, that where you feel like you've done something that's worthwhile with people who are worthwhile. And that also in the process of trying to get that film, first of all, made, and second of all, noticed, it involved me tapping every friendship that I had. I was joking before about being exploitative and trying to rip you off, Ed, but it wasn't really like that. It was like showing you the film and then you saying, you know, this is good. This is a good film. I want Anthony Bourdain to see it, or I want, you know, whoever to see it, and helping me. And you know, it does take a village to raise a film, and it took...
And to make a restaurant, Brandon.
And to take... And so there were a lot... To me, the relationships... I mean, I'm going to get mushy in a moment, but those relationships, you know, like Brandon and I we had a kind of careful relationship when the film was being made. I had to make it very clear to him that he had no control over what the shape of the film would be. That was, I think, a little difficult for him because he's used to being in charge of stuff, and I had to make it clear. I couldn't ever eat at the restaurant because I didn't want to be indebted in any way to the restaurant. I wanted that. But now that it's done, and it's got its own integrity, so now I can relax and be a real friend of Brandon's, which I never allowed myself to be while the making of the film was going on. And the same with the other people in the restaurant, the same with people like you, Ed, who've been helpful along the way. I just feel happy.
Yeah.
Sorry to sound so corny, but I just feel good.
Now, Brandon, I have a very important question. Now that the film is made, does Tom get comped? that's really one of the most important questions I ask any chef restaurateur.
You know, we make sure we spoil every one of our guests. Every one of our guests gets spoiled. So to that degree,
it's a very political answer.
In other words, no.
to that degree, you know, he'll be spoiled. That's for sure.
You know, I have a whole list of questions that I usually ask special sauce interviewees that I'm not going to ask, but I am going to ask you a couple of the special sauce all you can answer buffets. The first question is, and I'm particularly interested in what both of you have to say here. It's just been declared Thomas Lennon Day all over the world. What's happening on that day?
I go into hiding.
No. But what's happening all over the world? Because the fact that you go into hiding only affects one zip code.
What I would love is for people to be reading and watching things that are truthful and telling things to each other that are truthful, because to me the most disturbing thing about my world right now is that it's become a universe of polarized falsehoods in which everybody, the only thing anybody looks for is the piece, not everybody, but the piece of information that reinforces their already pre-existing prejudice. And everything that I've ever tried to do in documentary film has been to do the opposite of that, to just try to tell a story as I find it, regardless of how the preconception that I have or that anybody else has. And so that would be my dream. That would be my fantasy.
Mm. Yeah. What about you, Brandon? What's happening on Brandon Krastowski Day? Not just in Cleveland. We're talking all over the world.
You know, celebrating the power of food and second chances. That's really it. Just the idea that someone can, you know, is not who they were.
what's happening all over the world is that people are being given second, and in your case, from what you've articulated, and third and fourth, as many chances as they need. You can't stop believing,
yeah,
right?
That, and you know, let me think, you know, I actually want to change that. They're celebrating their perspective, no matter what that perspective is, because that's truly what this mission is doing. It's taking someone's past and saying, celebrate it. You know, reflect on it, learn from it, be better from it, but don't be ashamed or embarrassed of what your past was. That's what they're doing. They're mm-hmm. celebrating their past, you know, faults, their past victories, but they're celebrating what they've done. Everyone keeps talking about this ban the box, and I've argued against that. I say you should expand the box. You're essentially saying ban the box because that perception is going to hurt or harm your chances of getting employment, or someone's going to cast judgment. But if we expanded it and showed it how it renewed your perspective, then would it be complimentary to say, hey, this person, yeah, they did 4 years in prison, but here's another candidate who did 4 years at Yale, and the perspective of this person in prison is more valuable to me. If we expanded our past, no matter how gruesome or how mistake-ridden, that's what I'd want to celebrate. That's what I want to celebrate.
So you're talking about it's really acceptance,
yeah,
and an ability to
yes.
move forward.
Yeah.
That's really
That's
interesting
right.
because ban the box is all about don't let anybody
Expand
know
it.
Or be able to mm-hmm. find out that a person has been in prison. And
Expand
you're saying,
it.
No, forget that. Own the fact that you've been in prison. Own the fact of what you've learned from your time in prison. And how that learning can then make you a desirable employee to somebody who's interviewing
Correct.
You.
So ban the box,
I love that.
Is that a movement?
I'm sorry, yeah, I was going to explain that ban the box means don't allow people who are interviewing ask you whether...
Oh, to check the box.
Have you been convicted mm-hmm. of a felony?
Mm-hmm. Right.
That's the typical box. If
Got
yes,
it.
Please mm-hmm. explain.
Got it.
And so there's a whole movement to ban the box. And I agree. I don't think that's really the way
you
to
do
go.
A background
because first
check.
Of all, you know, there's a five-year gap in your resume.
Yeah.
You're like, you don't have to be a genius to figure out,
right.
you know, that there's a story there.
Yeah, right.
And rather than cover it up, because there's all sorts of stuff that people, when they come out of prison... There's studies that suggest that there's a kind of a determination to try to set things right that actually can work for an employer. For one thing, there's a greater loyalty. There's much less turnover. There's liabilities. You know, there's dangers of PTSD, of trauma coming and rearing its
sure.
head up. There's dangers of addiction and that problem coming back. So, yes, there are certain risks, but there's also an upside to it. And I think Brandon is talking about the upside that comes from learning from having really made a mistake and having
yeah.
learned from it.
You would wish on Brandon Krastowski Day that the world would always seem pregnant with possibility to mm-hmm. everyone.
You know, it's an old-fashioned idea. It goes back, most religions are steeped in that idea that we are sinners and that we fail and that failure does not define us.
Right.
And it's radical to put that into practice, which is what Edwin's is about.
All right. Well, listen, gentlemen, thank you so much. This has been awesome. And Serious Eaters, please watch Knife Skills. Go to newyorker.com and just type in Knife Skills in the search box. And really, it's been a pleasure having you both on Special Sauce. And we'll see you next time, Serious Eaters.
Thanks, Ed.